Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is your boy Jay Mason. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Album Cover, where we get inside the entertainment industry with those in the know and giving them their flowers while they're here to be celebrated. With me right now, I have a brother originally from the West Coast, went down to the A, got acculturated in the AUC, hip hop enthusiast, all that, and then some art behind the tape. Go ahead and take a look at the podcast, get the book, which I do have. My boy, my man. Real enjoy. Real. Thank you for coming on the podcast, bro.
Jay Mason, thank you for having me, man. I appreciate you, man. I appreciate you having me. I appreciate the introduction as well, man. You showed a lot of love too, as well, man.
Yes, sir. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast. Now, before we jump into all of the good stuff about your upbringing on the West Coast and coming to Atlanta, did you happen to hear about this little doc that came out not too long ago about the Freaknik in Atlanta? And you said
Yes,
you missed that era by a bit, right?
I definitely saw the hype and the buzz about the Freaknik documentary. I haven't seen it myself personally, and I did miss the Freaknik era. I used to come down to Atlanta when I was in high school. My mom used to send me down here in like 97, 98, 99, just to, spring break, winter break to visit family. But I never experienced a full live Freaknik the way that everybody was talking about it, the way the documentary is explaining it. So, no, I didn't see it, but I definitely heard about the Freaknik era, and I heard that it was what a time to be alive. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, a time was definitely had by those who went to Freaknik. Me being a preteen at that time, hearing about it from older cousins, and then having those So So Def Bass All-Star compilation tapes really set the picture of what it was like being live down in that action in Atlanta. So, where were you born, and what was your first musical memory coming up?
Born in Los Angeles, California, South Central LA to be exact. Western and Florence, 87th and Dinker, 63rd and Buckler, 57th and 51st and Fairview. That's North Englewood right there. But born and raised in South Central. First musical memories I can remember, purchasing my first album was with my own money. Warehouse Music in Culver City, right across from the Fox Hills Mall. I purchased Holy Cross Style, Criss Cross first album, and the Warren G and Nate Dogg regular singles. So those are the first two records I remember buying with my own money. So that's my first musical memory right there. So.
Wow, man. And you mentioned Totally Crossed Out. That my cousin had me dub that on a cassette tape. And think about with Atlanta and Totally Crossed Out, with Criss Cross and what they did for the hip hop scene in Atlanta, JD, and then of course DJ Nabs being very influential in the DJ scene in Atlanta. And we're going to talk about Club Kaya and all those nightclubs in Atlanta and how people were risking it all saying, I'm not going to go to work the next day because I'm willing to go clubbing on a Sunday night.
Big shout out to my man Nav too as well. But yeah, it's definitely part of the culture here in Atlanta when it comes to partying and the club scene. So we'll definitely get into that some more as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned Warren G, Nate Dogg, Regulate the G-Funk era. And I'm sure this was right around the time when, of course, nationally, everybody was paying attention to what was coming out west with Dre, the Chronic, then a year later, Snoop, Doggy Style. You mentioned Warren G with the Regulate G-Funk Era album came out in 94. So what was that like for you growing up out west and seeing after so many years of having to fight for recognition by the rap scene, everybody's eyes was what was coming out of Southern California?
I think it really took off when I want to say when Ice Cube. I remember my experience is when remembering when Ice Cube left NWA and see how people were garnered towards Ice Cube and how his solo project was everywhere. And then after that, the Chronic. Once the Chronic came out, it was nationwide thing. You knew that the West Coast had something going on when it comes to the West Coast sound. It was when it comes to producers with Dr. Dre. When it comes to artists like Snoop Dogg, Warren G, DJ Quick, so forth and so on. But I think at that time, that era, 91, 92, 93, that was the time when the West Coast was like formulating, getting his own, just getting his flowers really for being the dominant coast at the time. Because at the time, East Coast is still having on Smash. They still was, pumping their East Coast artists out like normally. But Ice Cube going solo, dropping America's Most Wanted, the Chronic dropping, and then Doggy Style, and then Warren G and so many other artists after that dropping made the West Coast take it to the whole other level. And that's what I remember growing up as. Like, I remember riding with my mom and hearing, the Chronic in multiple cars driving down the street, or hearing, Regulate, or hearing, Dog Pound, or hearing, Snoop Dogg everywhere. I remember the first time I remember seeing Doggy Dog World video. I remember seeing that at a friend of mine's house. He showed me the video. Like, yo, you seen this new Snoop Dogg video? He's Snoop Dogg's out of here. Even man, I remember the buzz behind it. So I definitely remember what was going on with the West Coast.
Yeah, when Cube went solo in 91 with America's Most Wanted, what a lot of people don't know, unless you're a real music head, if you look at the liner notes and album credits, production work on that album, I believe, was done by the Bomb Squad, who did most of
Yes.
Public Enemy stuff. Hank
Correct.
Shockley, Keith Shockley, Eric Sadler, and Howe. It was where certain artists are like, okay, I'm gonna mess with these West Coast guys and vice versa. But it was still that regionalism where everybody really wasn't collaborating, getting down with anybody outside of your region.
Right, that's true. That's very true. And Ice Cube took, you know, a turn for the right or for the east, I guess, by going with the Bomb Squad being his first solo project, and it just came out something totally different. The skits, the sound, the quality, everything was just different for that album, and it just took Ice Cube to a whole other level. So I definitely, you know, salute Ice Cube for doing that. That was definitely was something that was really, you know, innovative at the time, really.
Yeah, definitely that. And was it harder for Northern California rap acts to get exposure down in Southern California, like E-40, Too Short, and of course Hammer was huge at the time, so he was getting play everywhere. So was it where on Southern California rap radio it was primarily Southern California artists, or was it where you had your Northern California artists from the Bay sticking in?
No, we definitely showed well to the Bay Area. I mean, they didn't get as much play as they, sh I think they should have, but they definitely got play. You know, the Rappaportes, the Selly Cells, the Too Shorts, the E40s. You know, everybody like that. They're definitely familiar with their artists, the artists from the Bay Area and the music like that. But the thing about the Bay Area, they had the independent thing going on. So no matter what was going on in the Bay Area, they were gonna get their music out anyways. So with the independent movement that they had, so. It didn't matter what was going on in LA or not. They were still going to push their music out and get it out there. But we definitely showed up, Rappaportes, the Selly Cell, the Messy Marvs, E-40, San Quinn, you name it. Everybody from the Bay Area during that time, Who Riders. I'm trying to think who else from the Bay Area that we used to like bump really heavy. I remember the Who Riders, Rappaportes. Oh man, there's so many Bay Area artists that I show up to. JT, the Bigger Figure, people like that. They was definitely getting their play in LA too as well.
Yeah, and definitely one of the similarities between the Bay Area hip hop scene and the Atlanta hip hop scene, it's a go out, go get it, where you're gonna pop out the trunk, sell it independent, sell it at the mom and pop record store. You can go within your own area, and then by the time when the labels start seeing what you're moving, they're gonna come knocking. That what happened with Hammer, where he did Power,
Right.
Capital came knocking, and of course we all know with Hammer. Then of course Too Short, Jive, E-40, then Atlanta. I didn't know this until doing research that pretty much Back for the First Time by Ludacris was just a national repackaging of the
Yep.
Incognito album that was indie, and where they just took a couple of songs off the indie release and put a couple of new ones on for the national release.
Yes, very true, very true. I remember coming to Atlanta, like I said, 96, 97, 98, for spring break. And my mom sending me out here for, you know, winter break, and hearing Ludacris, Chris Level Level on the radio, him doing these freestyles, and I'm like, yo, this guy's pretty dope. Then he'll come out here again, 99, hear the song, What's Your Fantasy? On the radio already, and it's a big record. And then I don't hear it when I go back to LA. But then a year later, I come back. He has an album out on Def Jam. And it's like, you know, it's all about, you know, the regional. That's a different time though. The regional movement was different at the time. The regions that had their own sound where you can lock in and go somewhere different and hear a whole different artist or hear somebody totally new and get into the artist. But at the same time, it doesn't happen like that anymore. But definitely, I think, you know, that's something that really happened that really took over when it comes to the music scene.
Right. And was it definitely harder for acts that was non-West Coast to really break through out West? Because if you listen to the tempos of West Coast rap records and East Coast rap records, Ice-T had talked about it perfectly in a documentary about G-Funk, about how the California lifestyle is very laid back, so the BPMs are going to be much slower to go with the lifestyle. And when you listen to a lot of New York rap from 80s, 90s, golden era, is very fast paced to go with that hustle and bustle of the New York lifestyle.
Right. That's very true. I've heard that before. Like they sample, like the West Coast, we sample G-Funk. The East Coast samples like, you know, James Brown and other things, like other music like that, because it's fast paced. You know, it's more like, you know, more to the tempo of what the city goes like. I definitely believe that's true. I think at the time growing up in LA, the radio was different at the time. This was before the 1996 Telecommunications Act, so everybody didn't. There was just one radio station that was holding everything down. It was multiple radio stations, 92.3 The Beat. I remember listening to Julio G, and that's one of the main reasons why I'm in the radio now, because I used to listen to Julio G all the time. He used to have this thing called the 9 o'clock bomb, where he would play straight hip hop or a straight hour every day, but it would be B cuts. He'll play A Ball MJG. He'll play the Beat Nuts. He'll play E-40. He'll play Twista. He'll play, Common. You go down the list. You just name it. Anything from anywhere. If it was hip hop, he would play it. Same thing with, Power 106 at the time. They would play different records. So at the time, growing up, my era, we grew up on a lot of different things. So my palate was very, in tune to what was going on. I listened to a lot of East Coast music. I listened to a lot of West Coast music. Listened to a lot of Midwest music. Listened to a lot of Down South music. And Down South music, I was influenced through by not just by the radio stations, but by having family in the South and then tell me about, No Limit and Cash Money and Slip and Slide Records in Miami, where my family's from Miami, and my family in Atlanta tell me about, Ludacris and different artists here in Atlanta that was bubbling at the time. Drama, I remember Drama was big at the time. But yeah, that was the main thing right there. At the time, radio was totally different from what it is now, where you can listen to different things, and you could hear, and it would like school you to really what's going on in the music scene when it comes to hip hop, where you could hear about, a new A Boy MJG record. You could hear about, a new, Trick Daddy record, a new Beat Nuts, a new J. Rhythm Damager, a new Common, Twista, Psychodrama, you name it, the West Coast, Who Riders, DJ Quick, Second to None, so forth and so on. So that was the main thing about me growing up in LA. Like, the musical palette was wide open. I listened to all kinds of music as well as all kinds of hip hop music. But at the same time, I think that was the main thing growing up. Like, you could listen to everything, and it was showing love to everybody. Even though it's crazy as it sounds, like the East Coast, West Coast beef, like, Biggie got so much play in LA, it's crazy. Like, his Life After Death album, there's like maybe like, if you go on the radio now, listen to the radio now in LA, listen to some of the old school stations, and listen to what the music they play. He probably had 10 records on the radio off that double disc album. 10 records. I'm talking about like Hypnotized, Missing You, Sky's the Limit, Nasty Boy. You go down the list, just Money, More Money, More Problems. You just go down the list, it was both Notorious Thugs. So the East Coast, West Coast thing was just crazy to me, thinking about it in hindsight, because, we listened to a lot of Biggie. We listened to a lot of, artists from the East Coast.
Now, what led you to want to go to school down in Atlanta? And once you got there, was it where you formed a coalition with other hip hop peers and were trading music from different regions of the country? Say, hey, check this person out from Cali. Yo, check this person out from Cleveland. Check this person out from Chicago. And it was like a meeting of the minds in those dorm rooms.
Yes, definitely true. Well, what got me to come to Atlanta was I was deciding between going to UCLA, Cal State Fullerton, and Clark Atlanta, because I had been out here visiting family during spring break, and I checked out Clark Atlanta. They had a mass communications program, which I was interested in. So I didn't get accepted to UCLA. I got accepted to Cal State Fullerton, got accepted to Clark Atlanta. But I think in around, that was in June, early June of right after graduation, right before graduation. Excuse me. After that, I wrote a appeal letter to UCLA in July of like maybe right to July 4th. I found out that UCLA accepted me, but I had already made my decision to go to Clark Atlanta. So I was like, I'm out of here. I'm going, plus at the time, the UC system in California was saying that you can only graduate, the minimum years you can be in school is 5 years before you can graduate, because it's going to take a long time, the process of, going to school. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to take my chances down south and go to Clark Atlanta. And one of the best decisions I ever made in my life is going to Clark Atlanta. Now, when I get to Clark Atlanta, I'm at Brawley Hall. I meet people from everywhere: Chicago, New York, Texas, Florida, everywhere in between. People from the West Coast as well: Bay Area, Seattle, Arizona, so forth and so on. So once I get in the dorm, I connect with people. People are putting me on to mixtapes. That's one thing I learned about, because we didn't have that many mixtapes in LA growing up. Mixtapes, I hear, I finally see a DJ Crew mixtape. I finally see a, Neil Armstrong, all these DJs, Who Can, see their mixtapes, actually see the physical mixtapes from the people from the East Coast. When I go to, my man from Chicago, he puts me on to, people from Chicago, and listen to a lot of Midwest music, listen to a lot, he was putting me on to a lot of 3-6 Mafia music as well, put me on to a lot of, Psychodrama, Twista, Common. I mean, I was fans of their music already, but he really put me on to all their underground stuff, their in-release, independent stuff as well. So that was one thing about going to school. It was like the musical palette that you had was always giving new stuff because of, the people that you're with, and then people always schooling you to new stuff in the regions that they came from, they would always show up and say, you know, hey, check out this music right here from this artist right here. Somebody you probably wouldn't think of, or sorry, somebody you probably wouldn't listen to on a regular, but at the same time, they put you on and you be attached to it and listen to it on a regular. So that's the main thing about it.
Now, also at this time too, were other students from other areas in the AUC meeting and congregating amongst themselves, where Clark kids wasn't sticking with just the Clark kids? You were all mingling with Morehouse, Spelman, and was Clark Atlanta, not Clark Atlanta, excuse me, Morris Brown, were they still accredited at the time when you were down there in Atlanta?
Yes, Morris Brown was still accredited at the time. I knew, like, the crazy thing is, I just stood on Clark's campus. I knew a couple people that went to Morehouse, knew a couple people went to Morris Brown, but for the most part, I stayed on Clark campus and just got in tune with everybody I knew at Clark camp on Clark Atlanta's campus. So that was the main thing for me. But definitely, you know, people, you know, ventured off and went to Spell, visited people at Spelman, Morehouse, and Morris Brown as well, too.
So we mentioned Club Kaya earlier in DJ Nabs and how that was one of the premier night spots in Atlanta, where people were coming from other states to go party. So can we talk about the nightlife experience in Atlanta during your tenure there?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, growing up in high school in LA, we had a couple of teen clubs, the Soda Pop, Mavericks Flat on Crenshaw, a couple of spots like that, but nothing like coming to Atlanta and experiencing the clubs in Atlanta. I mean, I went to Club Kaya, I think one or two times before they shut it down. I was able to experience that a little bit. At the same time, I think that, you know, the club experience, my first club I remember going to was Club Jaguars, right on 15th and West P Street. My man from Cali, my man from the Bay Area, my man Ramon, and just experiencing the club like, yo, this is crazy, this is wild. And then them taking you on a shuttle, taking you down the street to the club, and then going from there to going to what was another club that we went to on a regular? Jaguars, Club Twins, clubs on the east side, the club that Ludacris did the With Your Fantasy video at the Atrium, went to a couple parties there. So the club experience in Atlanta, I mean, in college was just something that's mind-blowing. You're able to, you know, experience a club, experience, you know, being around adults, experience, you know, being in an 18 older club as well as being in a 21 older club. So it was a really good experience. I remember going to the Bounce. I remember just going to the club, the Bounce twice. I remember going there for Nelly and the St. Lunatics one time, and then going there to experience one party that happened, like a regular Friday night party that they had. But it was live. Like, the Bounce was a serious place at the back in the day. So I was able to experience all the clubs and the era of the party scenes in Atlanta. I mean, I wasn't here in the 90s, but especially in the 2000s, I was experiencing all the clubs that came out that was here in the city.
Right now, was nightclubbing in Atlanta pretty much a experience where it was almost invite only, where you had to even know the owner or the person working the door to get in, or have some type of social capital within the city to get in? Because Atlanta is a seen and be seen city, and it's also a city where everybody know everybody if you roll within certain circles.
Right. I think at one time later on down the line, it got to a scene like that. But when you first got to Atlanta, when I first got here in Atlanta in 01, I was paying to get in the club. Friday nights, club called Club, not Club Crucial, but Club. I forgot the name of the club. It was free. It was Northern Exposure. They had the East Coast room up top, and down south room was the basement, basically. It was free. It was $10 with college ID. So I was there before 11 o'clock. I was there every Friday night trying to get in. So it was one of the AG clubs. I think that was Get One's club from back in the day. But that was a major spot right there on Spring Street.
Right. And you mentioned Mavericks Flat out of LA being one of the prominent clubs out of LA. For those that don't know, Mavericks Flat, I believe, played a prominent role back in the day because a lot of dancers, they used to dance on Soul Train. That was one of the clubs that they would frequent. I believe Eric Kassim and a lot of people on Soul Train would use that club to scout for dancers.
You know your history. Yeah, definitely Maverick Flat, Soda Pops, clubs like that. Those were teen clubs. They had teen nights, I should say, but they would definitely, you know, be in there recruiting and have dancers in there. And people, the crazy thing is that's a lot of Soul Train with dancers came from those clubs right there. That's amazing. You know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, and if you when you think about, you know, Soul Train and what it did for hip hop culture, and how, you know, a lot of those dancers like Casper, Don Campbell Lock, Tony Basil, look her up, kids. She's more than just Nikki. The late Shabba-Doo, late Tyrone Proctor, and how they gave us popping, locking, waving, tutting, whacking, a lot of the dances that we see now all originated on Soul Train, and how Don was really a genius from taking the Chicago bread and bass show and moving it out west to where, okay, it's easier for me to book acts out in LA because the labels are based here. I'm going to get homegrown dancers to be on the show, and what dances they do is going to go national.
Yep, that's very true. Yeah, very true. Don Cornelius, excuse me, definitely ahead of his time when it came to the Soul Train movement. I mean, I saw the documentary and I saw the history behind Soul Train. It's definitely amazing what he did, how he took it from Chicago and then took it to national, being nationally syndicated, to then going to LA and moving. It really just changed the needle when it comes to black entertainment on a regular basis. Yeah.
Right, and for West Coast hip hop, can we talk about the importance of McCola?
McCola. The old school record label?
Yeah, old school record label distribution, because I believe a lot of West Coast acts before they got on to a
Yes.
major, they would press their records at McCola to get that indie buzz before the majors
Right.
came knocking.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the independent buzz come from. I mean, when it comes to the West Coast, I mean, definitely the Bay Area, of course, but definitely when it comes to the LA, I mean, definitely McCola. I think Eazy-E, I believe Ice-T, I believe a lot of people went through them and got their stuff pressed up for them. That's a little before my era because I was born in 83, so that's kind of before my era, but I definitely remember hearing about them and hearing how instrumental they were to the West Coast and how they were definitely getting their records played out.
Yeah, and I can remember when EPMD first came out with the Gas to Chill, a lot of people thought that they were West Coast because they sampled More Bounce to the Ounce, and they got a lot of love out West because, like how you mentioned earlier, a lot of West Coast record producers would sample a lot of Zapp, Parliament, a lot of those acts. So they got a lot of play out West and got a lot of tour shows out West too. And with you coming to Atlanta in 01, this was right around the time when Atlanta was about to break on a national scale, hip hop wise. They were already on the scene R&B wise, what JD was doing with So So Def and everything. But nationally, rap wise, Ludacris was about to explode with Back for the First Time. I
T.I.
believe
dropped
T.I.
T.I.
dropped I'm Serious, right?
He dropped I'm Serious that summer before I came to Atlanta. He dropped I'm Serious. Jeezy wasn't out at the time. Gucci Mane wasn't out at the time. But I think at the time, Lil Jon was buzzing at the time. Lil Jon's Kings of Crunk album had dropped, I think, right then. That was one of the big albums for my college, my freshman year. Real quick, rewind back to when you said about EPMD. The funny thing is, I thought EPMD was from the West Coast because they was from Brent. They said Brentwood through their records. I thought it was from like Brentwood, California, like near Beverly Hills. And they had all this funk and this sample, all this West Coast beats. I was like, oh, I thought they was from the longest. I thought EPMD was from the West Coast. And then I found out it was from Brentwood, New York, and they was from the East Coast. I was like, oh, wow. Eric Sermon is one of my favorite producers, top five producers of all time as well.
Yeah, so 01, Atlanta was about to buzz nationally. So what was that like for you being in that epicenter, seeing the rap scene take on the nation, and everybody's eyes was following Atlanta and saying, okay, we got to follow the South's lead because they're coming in like gangbusters.
It was amazing. It was amazing because I mean, within from 01 to 03, literally the South gradually just built their buzz going on with records and with artists coming out. T.I., Ludacris, Three 6 Mafia was putting out records. Then you had, South. This the South as a whole is putting out a whole bunch of records that really just took the South and gave them the crown. I mean, and on top of that, once you get to 05, when I graduate, GV is the highest thing in the country at the time with the snowman t-shirts and the snowman movement that he had going on. So I just imagine just seeing the crunk music going. I mean, that's what really took it off. It was a crunk music with Lil Jon and then artists that followed behind and followed with them at the same time, being released at the same time, T.I., Ludacris as well. But that was really the base that really just really took the South to the next level. And it seemed like, at the time, East Coast and West Coast and the Midwest were still doing their thing. You had Dipset, you had 50 Cent, you had Jay-Z, you had, Snoop Dogg still, you had the Game coming out within 05. But at the same time, it seemed like the South just kept putting out artists, kept putting out songs, kept putting out music. And it seemed like the South put out more regions as well. As well as Atlanta, there was Memphis putting out music, there was, Houston putting out music, Miami was putting out music. So it just seemed like it just all circumvented at the same time, and it was the perfect timing for the South to come together and do their thing. By the time of 03, South was the biggest thing buzzing.
Yeah, and for me being from North Carolina, I felt for the longest until when Little Brother, J. Cole, Rhapsody, Petey Pablo, a lot of those NC acts broke through nationally. It felt like we were following either what was coming from Atlanta or coming from New York, because they call North Carolina the Middle East because you got to pass through us in order to go to New York or to go to Florida. So we were getting a little bit of everything, but I really felt the game really changed for North Carolina hip hop was when Little Brother finally broke in, with the Listening, the Minstrel Show, and how it was where, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we're on. And then, of course, you later see the effects of that today with Rhapsody, J. Cole, and Coolie High, and all the other rap acts coming out of the Tar Heel State.
Yeah, definitely North Carolina. Definitely big shout out to North Carolina. I just actually came from Winston-Salem a couple of weeks ago for an event up there, but definitely, I think like Little Brother. I think that's just it's that Little Brother showed that the South had lyricism. That's one thing that Little Brother did, as well as different artists like Ludacris and certain artists around the South. It's going to show that we have lyricism in the South as well too. But at the same time, I think that the South as a whole, I mean, they never got the props they should have gotten. I mean, starting with Outkast and the Goody Mob and Uncle Luke and Ghetto Boys back in the day, they never really got the props they should have gotten because they put out classic music. They put out timeless music, UGK as well. But it seemed like the 90s, they was being overshadowed by what was going on with the East Coast, West Coast situation and just being not New York, being not being LA. It's being, stuck in the middle, but they kept doing their things, kept putting out their music. And at the same time, when it came to 01, 02, 03, I just think it was the right timing. And I think that, the fans kind of decided what was the sound of what was going on in the country. And I think the clubs, then being people being able to go to a club at that time, they kind of determined that, yo, the South was making music that's for the clubs, whether it's, booty shaking music or it's slow dancing music or it's, something. They're making music for the clubs and making energy for your car to shake, your car, the trunk to shake. So that's what it is when it comes to the South. And I think that was the perfect timing when it came to the South.
Right. And this was also right around the time when you had a perfect run of the mixtape game, and we could go down the list of all the DJs that put out great mixtapes during that period. Drama, Kool Kid, Absolute, Green Lantern,
Yes.
K-Slay, rest in peace,
Peace.
and just the gamut goes on with all those mixtapes. And being in Atlanta, you could probably get a lot of those at the flea market or to a little thing called Napster or Kazaa, BearShare, Morpheus. Check your website because you were willing to get an antivirus on your computer just to
Very
download
true.
your stuff. Or Datpiff.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Man, you took it back with Kazam and Napster. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I think growing up in LA, like I said, growing up in LA, we didn't have that many mixtapes on the scene, but we was able to get, snippets and stuff like that, little freestyles and little stuff like that. We get old CDs and stuff like that. But when I got to Atlanta, I was able to get, cats in New York, Jersey, Boston, DC, and they would have all the mixtapes. And then you would go down the strip on the AUC Promenade, and there'll people be out there selling, Absolute, K-Slay mixtapes, Dipset's new mixtapes, 50 Cent mixtapes, as well as DJ Drama, some of the people coming from the South as well too. So you was like, you any day with mixtape scene, that's how I kind of got introduced to the mixtape scene. One of the first mixtapes I ever bought was Dipset Volume 2 mixtape, as well as the Best of Joe Budden's mixtape. I think at the time, Joe Budden had just came out and he was on the freestyle, he was on the freestyle scene, on the mixtape scene heavy with the freestyles. So I just think that those were the two people I listened to heavy at the time. I think the rumor was at the time that Joe Budden was supposed to be Rasheed Wallace. Rasheed Wallace was supposed to be like acting as Joe Budden as a rapper, but at the same time being an NBA player. But that was just a rumor at the time. But I think that being in any day with, people from the East Coast and they're bringing stuff down, they're getting people to send them stuff and they're giving you update on what's going on in the mixtape scene in New York, you kind of get a closer, you get a closer interaction of what's going on and you get to see what the buzz is in the street in New York as well as down south in Atlanta as well.
Now, you mentioned California wasn't really big on the mixtapes. Why do you think that was?
Because we just, I think because we just more like, how would I put it? There was no real spots to sell like that. I mean, we had the swap meets, of course, but at the same time, the swap meets, they would sell regular records and they would sell mixed CDs. There would be like a blank CD, full of like all random artists that you can think of, East Coast, West Coast, everybody in between. But the DJ Clues, the K-Slays, the Tony Touches, the Absolutes, all the people like that, we heard of them on the West Coast, but we never really got their mixtape like that on the West Coast when I was
So,
growing up.
Now, also during this time in LA was Beggar Boys still on and going on the radio out in LA.
Yes, Beggar Boys, Big Boy. I mean, I remember listening to Big Boy when he was on at nights before he got on Morning Show. Beggar Boys was huge. Julio G was huge. There was a lot of people that was the West Coast. Like when it comes to the West Coast, like I remember, I miss the days when they used to mix on the weekends. They would start like Friday night, Friday afternoon, and they would mix all the way 72-hour mega mix all weekend long to Sunday evening. Just straight mixing, the DJs come in, just playing records, just everything you could think of. So I miss those days of that. Radio's changed like that, you know, it's been corporatized and stuff like that. But at the same time, those days you would just learn and hear so much music, it's just crazy. But at the same time, that's how I grew up on. That's what I grew up on when it comes to the radio and what music wise.
Yeah, it came up in that area as well because this was back in the day, people when radio used to do this little thing called day parting, where they would play rap after five or limited to just weekends because they didn't want to affect the ratings, and they would play liners like no rap weekends, no rap work day. Get you through your work day with no rap or some iteration of that, and they would play radio edits where they would edit the rap out completely, even if you had
What
a
do
song
you
that was on the pop or R&B charts. But if you
mean?
look at what 1580 K-Day did, shout out to Greg Mack. You can catch the interview that they were come on Beyond the Album Cover, and how K-Day pretty much took what was going on the East Coast with what Red Alert was doing on 98.7 KISS and what Mr. Magic and them was doing on 1.5 WBLS, and just took it to the extreme where we're going to play rap 24/7.
Yes, definitely. 1580 K-Day was pioneer to West Coast radio, West Coast music, period. I mean, Dr. Dre mixed on there. DJ Yell mixed on there. Eazy-E and NWA got their first plays on there. I mean, Ice-T got his first plays on there. 1580 K-Day was instrumental to what West Coast music is and what rap radio is to this day is, really. I mean, ideally, yeah. I mean, they brought it back now with 93.5 K-Day. It's still on the air now. They play, you know, throwbacks, stuff like that, and they mix on the weekends. But 1580 K-Day, I mean, that was instrumental and pioneer to what West Coast music became, basically. You know, I mean, that gave Dr. Dre his outlet. That gave DJ Yell his outlet. A lot of people that, you know, are on the radio now to this day have some connection to 1580 K-Day. So, okay,
Right.
that's important.
Right. Definitely an important part of hip hop story. And another important part of hip hop story, you mentioned Outkast and how Andre 3000 gave the shot across the bow when he said at the Source Awards, the South has something to say. And then, of course, Seven Playalistic, all the albums that came out after that. And to see the evolution now of Andre, where he put out an instrumental album of playing the flute. So, was that like to see hip hop's growth, especially his growth, to where, you know, being a young cat with Seven Playalistic, to where he's putting out an instrumental album and saying, it's okay for me to put this out. And if I want to rap, I want to rap. And I don't feel the pressures to have to recreate what we did with Speaker Box and Love Below. And I believe no rap album has won Album of the Year at the Grammys since.
Since, yeah, definitely. I mean, of course, Andre 3000 is so unique to. It's that's so unique to who he is. I mean, being a fan of Outkast growing up, I mean, that's perfect. Well, that just shows who he is and shows exactly how he wants to be as a person. Andre 3000, Outkast, of course, they're Goody Mob, Dungeon Family. They were pioneers of Atlanta, the Atlanta sound. You can't mention Atlanta rap without mentioning Organized Noise or mention Outkast or Goody Mob. So, Andre 3000, I mean, it's dope that he's able to do what he wants to do now when it comes to music, still express himself musically, but at the same time, do something different and still be on one accord of how he feels and he wants to be. You heard recently Lil Jon supposed to be dropping a meditation album too. How it was that Lil Jon, who was the king of crunk, is now dropping a meditation album. So that just shows how everything is 360 and, you know, everything turns around whenever, you know, it wants to. And I'm very interested to hear it. I mean, I definitely listened to Bye Bye to Andre 3000's album. He was just here in the city. He did a live performance, a couple live performances here in Atlanta. But at the same time, I think it's dope that he's able to do that. And, you know, he can look back at his career and say, hey, you know, I was pivotal at starting the South movement. I put my foot down and told the world that the South had something to say. I was able to make my, you know, get my awards, get my accreditation, get my, you know, all my accolades with my career when it comes to putting the South on with, you know, the speaker box Love Below. as well as, you know, classic albums like Aquemini. People don't talk about Aquemini, ATA Aliens, how classic those albums are. But at the same time, Speak of Box, Love the Love is the one that got the Grammy. So of course he's gonna get that love right there. And then he's able to, you know, do his own thing and then come back the way he wants to. So I gotta respect that and gotta love that.
Yeah, you gotta love the growth. You gotta love the evolution. Now, the one act, hip hop wise, that I think should have blown up nationally. True hip hop heads know their importance and the significance of this collective. Definitely out west, but I think nationwide, I think everybody's just like, I don't really know. So, can we talk about the significance and importance of Souls of Mischief and Hieroglyphics?
Wow, classic, classic. I don't know, man. I think that's that. I don't know how they didn't blow up the way they should have. They definitely had an underground feel. They definitely had lyricism on deck, had great beats, great production, great, you know, just a great synergy between all of them. But at the same time, for some reason, we just couldn't get them to blow on a national level. But I mean, they definitely still tour to this day. That's crazy. I seen one of my friends last night. He's from the Bay Area, Brandon, and he had a Souls of Mischief 93.2 Infinity jacket on. So it shows how ill they are. And I think maybe before they came out, maybe before the Commons, the Mos Defs, the Tyler Kwali, that Soulquarian vibe, the Roots kind of like really took off and came together as a collective. But I think to this day, Souls of Mischief, Hieroglyphics, you know, those artists like that are amazing. Like, I still listen to the Souls of Mischief first album, man. I mean, to this day.
Yeah, man, I had a chance to go see Souls of Mischief. I didn't, but it was because I only got tickets to go see the Force Hip Hop Tour when they came to Albuquerque. They were performing at a spot 45 minutes from my crib. I was like, Souls of Mischief or Force? So I went to go see the Force. But you know, with that tour, if you were lucky to go see that tour live, it was like Halley's Comet, because I believe it won't happen again. Because at my stop, you had LL, Roots, Jazzy Jeff, DJ Z Trip,
Rakim,
Rakim,
Salt and
Big
Pepper.
Boy. Surprise guest at my stop was a Bone Thugs and Harmony. But it was where it felt like for me, it was like watching Rap City, The Box, Video Music Box, all those your favorite national and regional hip hop video shows all roll into one to celebrate hip hop's 50th last year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing about going back to Hieroglyphics and Souls of Mischief, that just shows the uniqueness of the Bay Area and how, of course, they're independent, but at the same time, they just have a whole variety of music. You have Too Short, E-40, but in the same sense, you have Souls of Mischief, Hieroglyphics, Paris come out of the Bay Area. So just the Bay Area was so unique as a city, as a place for hip hop as well. So it just shows the uniqueness of them.
Now, what was it like for you when you saw Usher perform halftime at the Super Bowl? And did that kind of feel like a full circle moment for Atlanta to be on that international stage with him headlining the
Oh
halftime
yes,
show?
definitely. I mean, shout out to Usher. He represented the A to the fullest. He represented as well, but it just showed that, you know, one, hip hop and R&B is the number one genre of music in the world, no matter what. It's been like this for the last 20+ years, and I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. Two, it shows that Atlanta is the hub for Black music, the Black Mecca in the United States when it comes to music, when it comes to culture. And three, it shows that how big and how far we came as a culture from being, you know, boycotted at the Grammys to not performing at the Super Bowl to, you know, get to, you know, the whole situations we've had before coming up in hip hop being, you know, the dark horse of, you know, the music industry. But now we're at the forefront of it, and it shows that, you know, he had a Ludacris out there, had a Lil Jon out there, had will.i.am out there. So it just shows how dope hip hop is. Jermaine Dupri as well. Big shout out to Jermaine Dupri. And just shows how well the hip hop is cooking and how hip hop and R&B has gone so far. And ATL is the main reason why.
Yeah, and you know, before Social Def and JD, we had the SOS band coming out of Atlanta and putting the stamp on the map. But really, when you think of music and the scene in Atlanta, you think about JD and Social Def. So can we just talk about his impact on the industry and in Atlanta in general, to where, you know, he was a kid on tour at the Fresh Fest dancing, you know, that was done by Michael Marden, who's his dad, and of course his stuff with Silk Times Lover, and then Criss Cross and the Brat, Bow Wow and everything to come out of that. So can we just talk about his importance and his legacy, not only to the Atlanta scene culturally and musically, but internationally, because he's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame too, I believe.
Right, yes, he is. I mean, when I met Jermaine Dupri, I gave him his props. I was like, yo, man, you are like this cornerstone of my hip hop. Me getting into hip hop with Toby Crossed Out, Criss Cross. I was the biggest fan then. Then, you know, you put out DeBrad, I bought DeBrad's album. You put out your first album, Life in 1472, which I think is a classic to me. I told him I'll give that album 5 mics. That was a classic to me. I love that album to this day. And all the artists you put out to this day, I think that Jermaine Dupri has just slept on. Like he said in an interview I saw the other day, that what artist you, what producer or, you know, music mogul you know to this day had a number one record in 92, has a number one record in 2024. It's a 30-year span. Nobody has that. Nobody has that. He had Criss Cross. He had Criss Cross with Toby Crossed Out in 1992. He has Money Long's record out right now in 2024. Who can say that? He's always had Atlanta on his back. Always put his flag down there. Done multiple genres from R&B to hip hop. You know, he's worked with everybody from Usher, Mariah Carey to, you know, Jay-Z, B.I.G. You know, you name it. So it's just Jermaine Dupri, just he's a musical genius, and he definitely deserves his props. And he always puts the A on his back, always shows love to the ATL. So big shout out to Jermaine Dupri as well.
Yeah, the one thing I would have wished happened, you know, when Criss Cross was at their peak, Another Bad Creation was at their peak at the same time too, you know, with Kevin Wells, also they're out of Atlanta. Man, that would have did gangbusters had ABC and Criss Cross would have did a tour, because you know they were the two hottest kid acts at the time, and of course Criss Cross was in the Jam video with Michael Jackson.
Right. I mean, talking to DJ Nav, I used to work with DJ Nav. I used to talk to him all the time, and he would be blown from my, like, I would talk to him like, yo, I can't believe you was on tour with Criss Cross. Like, I mean, I'm the biggest Criss Cross fan. I grew up, like, I was the biggest Criss Cross fan. He would be blown away like, yo, that's crazy you thinking like this. But I'm like, yo, you got to remember, I was a kid at the time, so that was the biggest thing in the world at the time. You were just, you know, going on tour, you know, going on tour, being, you know, daily life for you, but at the same time, this was huge to me. So I used to always question about, you know, how was Criss Cross on tour? What was it like going on tour with Michael Jackson, stuff like that? And he was like, yo, it's crazy that you mentioned you have this like affinity for it. It shows that, he said it shows how big that Criss Cross was and how big that movement was with Social Death when it comes to Criss Cross. But I think, you know, that Criss Cross was instrumental to the sound of them blowing up the ATL, not blowing up the ATL, but blowing up that kid sound. I think that Jermaine Dupri has one thing that he can do. He can take a young child or a young girl and turn them into a star, because he knows how to produce them and make them to the masses. So it's amazing how he can do his thing.
Yeah, and he knows talent too, because if you look at the rap game, you know, with Lotto came off a rap game, and current LSU basketball player Flaugey, she was on the rap game, you know.
Right, that's right.
So JD has an eye for talent, and like you mentioned with Criss Cross and Bow Wow, he knows how to get the best and knows that sweet spot of crafting records that's good for kids, but also older than
radio.
Kids can knock it too. So he knows ears for radio.
Right, definitely has ear for radio for real. So big shout out to him again. Like I said, Criss Cross, one of the biggest groups of all time. Yeah, one of the biggest groups of all time.
Right, and you mentioned earlier the symbolism with Atlanta and Miami with Uncle Luke. Because if you go back and listen to a lot of the earlier underground Atlanta rap, a lot of them mirrored what was going down in Miami with the Miami bass, DJ Toon, MC Shy D, Kilo Ali, Raheem the Dream, DJ Taz. A lot of those acts pretty much was influenced by what was coming down of Miami, and then of course Uncle Luke bringing the whole Miami bass sound nationally, and then which paid way later for what was to come with Slip and Slide with Trina, Trick Daddy, Rick Ross, and of course DJ Khaled.
Yeah, definitely, definitely true. I mean, my mom, rest in peace, my mom, her family's from Miami. So I used to go down to Miami all the time. They had pirate radio down there. I remember listening to pirate radio when they would play, you know, you go to turn signals on the dial tone and you would hear different radio stations across the city and stuff like that. So Miami had its own sound. I think Uncle Luke, on top of just bringing that 808 and that bass to the national level, as well as that, him having that parental advisory sticker, him going through all that controversy, did put a lot of eyes on him too as well, and made his music even bigger than what it was, on top of, you know, what it was already, but made it even bigger because You had the federal government coming at you on top of that. So that was one thing that too that people forget about, and people try to don't remember. But the federal government was on Luke at the time, and he had to go to court, and he had to go through hell, and he put the, like you said, he put the South on his back to represent for us, and he did it.
Yep, and because of Uncle Luke, you could be as nasty as you want to be. There
Right,
wouldn't be no
exactly.
wop. There wouldn't be no put it in your mouth. None of
Right.
that. If Luke didn't have the cojones to stand up to the Supreme Court and say, "You're not violating my First Amendment rights to free speech. I can put out what I want to put out," because people were getting arrested for selling nasty as they want to be in the record stores.
Right, exactly. People were getting arrested for that. So it just shows that, Uncle Luke was really doing his thing and really trying to, was really had an independent mindset. Like, yo, I'm going to put this music out the way I want to. No matter what people say about it, no matter what the government thinks about it, I'm going to put this music out, and it's going to make a change in the world. And he definitely did change the world, because that parental advisory sticker is still out to this day on all music around the world.
Right, and one producer who I felt in the scene of hip hop doesn't get talked about enough in terms of what they did for the culture, because he was a producer during hip hop's early years when hip hop was finding its sea legs, and he gets lost in the conversation. But the late Larry Smith, his work with Run DMC, Houdini,
Right.
and if you listen to Action by Orange Crush. That was the basis for Sucker MCs, and Dr. Dre ended up sampling that for Nicey for Michelle. So can we just talk about Larry Smith and how when we talk about hip hop producers, he doesn't get mentioned enough.
Doesn't get mentioned enough. He's a legend in the game. I mean, he definitely drew some of the early records for hip hop, like you said, the pioneers, like the hip hop's first rock group, Run DMC, rock star group, Run DMC. So I think, he doesn't get his props, and we should, talk about him more, definitely when it comes to hip hop. I mean, like you said, he's in the era before me. I was born in 83, so that was when and Run DMC was just blowing up at the time. But I definitely think that he was what you call a pioneer. I definitely remember hearing about his name and hearing seeing his name in the credits, and seeing that, he produced a lot of stuff with Houdini, Run DMC, so forth and so on, and he should get his props and should get flowers to this day.
Yeah, and I think also mentioning Uptown Records don't really get talked about enough as well. The late Andre Harrell and
Right.
what Uptown did with meshing hip hop and R&B, with rest in peace, Heavy D and the boys, rest in
Ooh.
peace, Trouble Tree Roy, Finesse & Sequence, Groove Be Chill. Marley
Right.
Marl was actually on Uptown and did some cuts off of Heavy D's Living Large album. Eddie F, who I feel doesn't get talked about enough as
Right.
top producers, hip hop, R&B. And then, of course, Guy with Teddy Riley, and how Teddy, he was that first producer to seamlessly go back and forth between
Sure.
R&B. Hip hop to do Keith Sweat, to do Guy, and then turn around and do I Get the Job Done for Big Daddy Kane. So can we just talk
Yeah.
about Teddy Riley and how his fingerprints are heavy over the industry?
Right. Let's rewind it back to Uptown Records. Like, Uptown Records was a staple in hip hop when it comes, staple in the music industry when it comes to black music. I mean, like you said, Heavy D, one of my favorite artists of all time. Heavy D was the coolest, smoothest brother in the game. Like, I love Heavy D. Heavy D was so cool to me. Like, I mean, he was a overweight dude, but at the same time, he was cool. He was finesse. He was fly. He seemed like he got along with everybody. He seemed like he was cool. And then him as an artist, he brought in his skill, got into the acting side of things. I always was a big fan of Heavy D, rest in peace. So, Uptown Records was a pivotal record label when it comes to hip hop R&B, and I can't wait to see the documentary that's coming out from them about the Uptown Records story. But moving forward to Teddy Riley, Teddy Riley is a musical genius. I mean, musical genius. Black Street Guy, Keith Sweat, Bobby Brown. I mean, you name it. I mean, R&B wise, I mean, he's produced for everybody from Jay-Z, to Big Daddy Kane, so forth and so on. So, like, Teddy Riley, I mean, he's a genius. I mean, he's like, he put Pharrell in the game, won another genius in the game. So you got to remember that too as well. Has hits for days, produces, has his own sound, created a sound, New Jack Swing. So, I mean, what else can you say about the man, dude? I mean, musical genius.
Right. And you mentioned Bobby Brown. And of course, with Bobby moving to Atlanta, he set up Boss Town Studios, which later became Stankonia
Yeah.
Studios for Outkast. And another descendant of that New Jack Swing sound was Dallas Austin, who got put into the game by Joyce Fenderella Erby from Climax, who discovered also Sammy and Lloyd, and how some of his early production credits was on Troop's Attitude album doing My
Wow.
Music. And it was another Troop record that I can't recall at the moment, but can we talk about Dallas Austin, how I feel, even though with all the stuff he did with TLC, he gets mentioned for that, but the one piece don't nobody really talk about that they should, the Highland Place Mobsters album that he did.
Yeah, he's another legend when it comes to ATL. I mean, he definitely is incorporated in this in the history of ATL when it comes to production wise. I mean, you gotta think of early 90s, you thought of Jermaine Dupri, you thought of Dallas Austin, you thought of Organized Noise. So you have to remember, you have to mention Dallas Austin. I mean, he's like you say, he done has a diamond album with TLC. He's done, stuff with Monica, done stuff with, Lloyd, Sammy, so forth and so on. So I think, people don't mention him enough, but Dallas Austin should definitely get his props when it comes to production and being part of the quality sound when it comes to ATL.
Yeah, definitely that. Now, how did you and DJ Mars end up connecting?
I connected with DJ Mars my senior year. I was a senior in college, and we started doing promoting parties and doing stuff like in the street, doing street marketing and promo. And he needed some work from stuff, and we found out we both went to Clark. Started talking, and we was like, cool. We kept in touch with each other after we do one of the parties and started promoting some of his parties. Him and Super Friends were doing him and Super Friends and Team FCC were doing at the time. So I started promoting with him, and then that's how we became cool.
All right, so talk about the Super Friends and how big that movement was in the Atlanta nightclub scene.
Man, there wasn't a party in the city that Super Friends wasn't DJing, whether it was, I mean, you name it, from Mars to Doc to Trauma to Drama, Don Cannon, DJ Sense, you name it, Boom Bip, Fahrenheit, Tay Rock, you name it. They were every party, they was at the party DJing. So Super Friends was just a stamp when it comes to the ATL DJ movement. I mean, they was one of the biggest DJ crews in the city.
So now, was it where to most of them had an exclusive tag on a certain club that other DJs couldn't get in to spin? Or was it where anybody could get in any nightclub in Atlanta to spin? Or was it where, okay, we got our resident DJ here. So it was a little bit harder for somebody on to come up to get their foot in the door.
I think it was a resident DJ. I think it was a lot of relationships. We talked about that. You talked about earlier that relationship situation where they had, who is that who situation. It kind of worked out in that situation when it comes to Super Friends. I think because Mars was DJing the Compound, Visions, the major clubs in the city. Then you had Stints and Drama doing the small clubs, but not small clubs. But I mean, like doing like the lounges and stuff like that at one time, but then they started going on during started doing Compound, started doing the Visions as well too. So it just they had it unlocked. I mean, they were just a crew that had the DJ, they had the DJ crew unlocked, and they were doing all the high end parties. I know they were doing all the like album release parties on Tuesday at the Compound. I mean, at Visions, it was always a Super Friends DJ doing the party. So I mean, they just had a stamp, and they were just like a collective of DJs that was really putting it down for the city and really just showing that they had a crew that was talented, that could rock a party, that could hold it down, and you would go make sure you guaranteed to have a good time when you go to their parties.
Yeah, so this is probably also the time when you still had street teams out doing promo where, like, hey, go out to so-and-so club, pass these flyers, pass these samples out, get the word out. So how heavy presence was the street team, primarily either for So-So Def or for LaFace out and about during the Atlanta nightlife scene during that time?
I myself used to intern for DTP, so I used to do promotions marketing for DTP. So anything that DTP had out, I would go to the clothing stores. I would give nighttime street promotions as well as on top of that, doing the clubs, doing promotion with different clubs as well too. So it was just definitely LaFace and Social Def did definitely had a presence out there. But I remember myself personally doing stuff for DTP and then seeing, the promotions truck of DTP, Social Def, all around the city, giving away stuff and giving away promotional stuff. So I think that it was definitely at one time the promotional scene was huge here in Atlanta like that, especially
Rap
after All Star,
Vans.
especially Rap Vans, especially after 03, after All Star Weekend was here, it took off after that. I mean, it was crazy after that.
Rap Vans, throwback jerseys, t-shirts, and being pulled up by Walters. Can't even talk about the importance of Walters in Atlanta.
Oh, it's a staple. Stable when it comes to the one of the places he got to visit when he got to Atlanta. Rest in peace, my man Sean Duke, one of the guys that used to work there. And he was a cool cat that used to hold down for people when they came to the store. A real cool cat. But a staple when it comes to fashion in the city. If you want to get a throwback jersey, you want to get Nike Air Force Ones, you want to get your Michael Vick jersey at the time, you want to get an Atlanta Hawks jersey, you want to get anything that you think your hands on, you think of, you gotta go to Walters and get your stuff from Walters. So you pull up right there on Decatur Street, right across Georgia State. Pull up and go in there and get your shoes, get your stuff, get your gear. I mean, Walters is a staple. It's been around for over 50 years plus, and it's not going anywhere when it comes to Atlanta fashion.
No, definitely not that. And then when we think about today's time with algorithms, things going viral, trends, this man, while he caught flack then, but looking at him now, he was a genius. Can we talk about the genius of Soulja Boy and what he did for the now viral movement?
Oh, man. People don't give him his props, man. He deserves his props. I mean, he definitely was the one who started the trend of going viral, being a young, like Jermaine Dupri, under the tutelage, not tutelage of Jermaine Dupri, but under the tutelage of Zakai Park, but having that same pathway, but taking it to a whole other level by using the internet at the time to go viral. I mean, Soulja Boy doesn't get his props. I mean, he definitely changed the game when it comes to really getting his name out there to the masses and using the internet to his advantage.
Right.
I
And
mean,
then that whole snap era, looking at it now, you're more appreciative of it. Me, I was one of the ones that hated it at the time, because whenever I see a Mr. Chico stick bar, I think a doop, doop, doop. I'm like, no, 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 no,
yep.
no. But, you know, rest in peace, Shorty Low. But just how D4L and that whole movement, it brought fun into hip hop and dance, because there was a time where in hip hop, it wasn't cool to dance. The only dance you did was when you was grinding up on the girl, but not no coordinated snap, 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 throw it up in the air and snap again. So can we talk about that whole snap, snap era and how we're more appreciative of it now?
I think we're definitely more appreciative now because of, at that time, I think we were going through a time where we were all into sections and VIP situations when it comes to clubs in Atlanta. So I think that was good that snap music came out, because it broke that VIP area up. I mean, it didn't break it up, but at the same time, it let people know that you can get back on the dance floor and have a good time. Because a lot of these songs, snap clubs on the west side, it wasn't the compounds or the visions or the main clubs, the big clubs that you know everybody goes to, the glamorous clubs. Those parties, those dances came from the west side, from the hood. So people were still not in the VIP section. They were in the middle of the dance floor having a good time. So I'm glad that those songs came out, because they broke up the monotony of, you know, people being in the VIP section, having a bottle, stuff like that. It brought people back to the dance floor, having a good time, and, you know, really enjoying yourself in the club. So I was really appreciative of that. I didn't hate that era at all at one time.
Yeah, and you mentioned you were interning for DTP, being around the whole situation. Now, to me, one of the greatest rebrands in hip-hop, you know, was 2 Chainz.
Two
Because you
Chainz.
remember when 2 Chainz first came out, he was originally Titty Boy, and they had Player Circle, Duffel Bad Boy, Lil Wayne then later came out as 2 Chainz, rebranding himself and became what it is. So can we talk about how you're able to see that rebrand from the ground up when he was originally Titty Boy and now 2 Chainz?
I mean, he definitely just took what he had and just rebranded himself to the fullest. I remember going to Miami for spring break, not spring break, for Memorial Day weekend in 04 with the whole DTP crew. We were staying in a mansion. It was me, Dawa, my man Corey Goose, and 2 Chainz. We were staying in the guest house at this mansion. And this is like before, this is DTP, what was the name of that album, the compilation album that came out. This was there during that time. So this was like 2 Chainz was just getting featured, just getting on, stuff like that. Titty Boy, we call him Tit to this day. So people, if you know him, you still call him Tit. But 2 Chainz at the time, I mean, he just took the independent route, got himself independent, and really just took himself to the next level with his coming music, and really just rebranded himself. And it's taken off, and it's worked for him. And I'm so proud of what he's done for himself, man. I'm really proud of what he's done for himself. See how he started off being, you know, everybody's connect here in Atlanta when it comes to the city, to being the man who is got his own entity, got his own brand now.
And, you know, with Atlanta being synonymous with Black culture being synonymous with sports. Of course, you got the Hawks, you got the Braves, you got the Falcons. So can we just talk about the movement and what Atlanta was like at the time when that man from the 757, Michael Vick, touched down in Atlanta and really brought swagger to Atlanta sports that you haven't really seen since when primetime was suiting
Right.
up for the Falcons.
Yeah, I mean, when Michael Vick came my freshman year, 01, and he changed the city. Like, I mean, everybody was Michael Vick fan. I mean, he just changed the culture of the NFL as being a run pass quarterback and being that guy, you know, being unapologetic of who he was. I mean, you would see Michael Vick out in the clubs. I remember South Beach on Friday, on Sunday nights after the games, and he was in the city. He was going to be at South Beach, you know, pulling up and him and his boys having a good time and stuff like that. So Michael Vick was definitely like the precursor, the after effects or the aftermath of the Dion era, the Dominique era, Dominique Wilkins era. I can't remember nobody in the mid-90s or the late-90s besides though, Steve Smith or somebody for the Falcons. I can't remember with Jamal Anderson. Jamal Anderson was here, you know, Dirty Bird, you know, I remember that era as well too. But after that era, you really can't think of nobody else when it comes to the Falcons. But Michael Vick took it to the whole other level. I mean, he just definitely rebranded the Atlanta Falcons as a team, as a culture, and made them one of the biggest teams in the city, made the biggest teams in the country, as well as he was the biggest thing in the city.
Yeah, now the Falcons have gone Macy's with them getting Kirk Cousins, and we all know Kirk Cousins will be going to
Not
Waffle
Macy's.
House before 5 o'clock. He's not going after midnight.
No, he's not. He's definitely not gonna be in the Waffle House after midnight. He's gonna be home in bed or studying his book or studying his routes and stuff like that. He won't be in the Waffle House after 5 p.m. I should
Yeah.
say. But definitely, Michael Vick was he was definitely at the Waffle House after 12 midnight. We
Yeah,
believe it.
yeah. If you go to Waffle House after midnight as a fellow Southerner, you got to know how to throw hands because the element is heavy at the Waffle
Yes.
House. If it doesn't smell like loud, kush, gas, dank, black and mild, or backwoods, then you're not at the right Waffle House.
Right.
Now, we mentioned how, you know, when Atlanta got the Olympics in 96, it was where you saw a lot of cleaning up of the city because they figure, okay, we're gonna have the international stage on us, and how, you know, Freaknik was going on. But once they got the Olympics, they figure, oh, we got to start prepping. So it almost is
Right.
kind of like we're pushing this out in order to attract a certain set of dollars of bodies. And now, what did you think that whole shift meant for Atlanta culturally when that started happening once Atlanta got awarded the 96 Olympics?
I think it took away some of the essence of the true Atlanta because it turned to Atlanta to a transplant city where a lot of people are here. When you go around the city right now, you ask 10 people, where you from? 8 out of 10 are going to say they're not from Atlanta. Whereas before the 96, you probably would have 5 out of 5 will say, you know, they're from Atlanta, or the 5 will say they're not from Atlanta. But I think it took a lot away the essence of who the city is. And you can see that in this BMF documentary right now, the BMF documentary, BMF show right now, where they talk about Techwood Home, they talk about Capital Home, they talk about some of the projects that are gone now. There are now apartment complexes now. But I think it took away the essence of the real ATL of, you know, the city of who it is. Because now Atlanta is a transplant city. So a lot of people here, including myself, I flew here. I wasn't born here. I flew here. So that's the thing that a lot of the natives say. They say, I was born here. I didn't fly here, basically. But at the same time, I feel that, you know, it took away the essence of the city with the 96 Olympics. And it's going to happen again, too, in the next 2 years with the World Cup coming here, too, as well. So it's going to change, revitalize the city, and do some more things to the city as well. So it changed and cleaned up the city a lot, but at the same time, it took away a lot of essence of the city, of who the city was before 1996.
Yeah, and you mentioned BMF, and I'm sure Meech and them were in the clubs heavy because we saw the big billboard said BMF. I mean, you literally are letting the people know we are here. Come try to get us. So, can you talk about how heavy in the streets, in the nightclubs, BMF and their associates were?
I mean, I remember seeing the point of divisions and them being in that back parking lot, and you can look at the cars and just say, you know, Benz's, Rolls Royces, Bentley's, you name it. Every fancy, expensive car you think of was in that back parking lot. Remember seeing them in the club on top of the bar, standing on top of the bar where you, a rapper, the biggest rapper in the game couldn't do that, but BMF could do that. So They had it on lock. I mean, they had it on lock. They showed love to the city too as well. I mean, like that Big Meech's birthday party was one of the biggest events, one of the biggest events probably in Atlanta history. The way he had his party, he ran out of the compound, had all kind of animals there. It was like a jungle party event like that. Then they went to the Magic City after the party, told them to stay open later on, paid everybody, had a ball. But BMF definitely, had an era. It was an era in the city. And they definitely did their thing to the fullest. I mean, it's good to see the TV show now, kind of reliving how things started with them. But at the same time, I was here. I seen BMF everywhere. I seen them pull up to a birthday bash with Jeezy, and it was about 100 guys outside of birthday bash trying to get in. And I remember the program director at the time was like, "Okay, now we can't let all you guys in here. It's too crazy." I remember getting their mixtapes. I remember getting the Juice magazines. I remember seeing them everywhere. So yeah, BMF was everywhere, and they definitely had a presence within the city.
Now, were there other clubs in Atlanta where, okay, we can't get into 112, but we know for sure we could get in this club if this club is busy, and what folks kind of strategize, like, okay, this is Club A. If we can't go to Club A, we go to Club B, Club C, so on and so forth.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I can't think of a club, so many clubs to this day I can't think of, but there's always options. Back in the day, there was a party scene like Monday through Sunday, you had options. Monday, you want to go out, you can go to a lounge, you can go to a club, you can go to an event, whatever the situation may be. And that was like that for every day. So there's always something, it was always options. So if you couldn't get in the big party, you can always go down the street to another party that was probably. You probably have a good time in there as well, just as big as the big party as well too. So that's how it was in Atlanta at one time. I think it's totally changed and it's totally different now, but at the same time, in the back in like my prime, 01 through like 09, every night you can go out and have a good time and you had
Now,
multiple options.
yeah. So it was like the pick of the litter. Now, how heavy was Bad Boy's presence in Atlanta, with 112 being signed to the label, and of course, knowing that Puff was down throwing parties and everything like that? How heavy were they in the Atlanta clubs scouting for talent?
I wouldn't say they would be scouting the talent, but their presence was definitely felt here in Atlanta. I mean, definitely Puff threw a lot of parties. I remember one time he called the radio station, called Greg Street, like, "Yo, I'm coming to Atlanta tonight. I'm throwing a party in Visions. Everybody pull up in all black." And the city came out like crazy. So I remember Puff doing stuff like that. I remember Bad Boy Chris's party. I remember, hearing about him doing the Bad Boy events, doing Freaknik and stuff like that. I remember hearing about that stuff. But at the same time, Puff's presence and Bad Boy's presence was still here in Atlanta. You can feel it. I remember 03 for All-Star Weekend. There was definitely a presence with them here. The street team was everywhere. And then later on, he did the Bad Boy South thing with Young Jock, Kuro Zo. Their presence was definitely here on the street team side of things, as well as in the clubs. If Puff is Puff, so you know what kind of music you're going to get from him. You know what type of party scene, party energy you're gonna get from them too as well. So his energy was definitely down here in the South.
Yeah, and then also you had LaFace, and it's crazy to think, LA and Babyface decided to settle on Atlanta and all the acts that came out of Atlanta. How if it wasn't for that LaFace Christmas compilation, we wouldn't have Outkast, because that's how Players Ball ended up getting buzzed,
Then
which led to them doing Seven Playlists of Cadillac Music.
playlistic, yeah, definitely. I mean, that album right there, Toni Braxton, Babyface, TLC, Outkast, was all on that album, man. That pioneered the face sound. So you got to give them props. You got to give props to L.A. Reid. Got to give props to Babyface for what they did and bringing that, and having the idea to come from, L.A. and to come to Atlanta and basically, create a label here that birthed one of the biggest cities in the South, the biggest cities in the country, I should say, actually.
Right, and then we mentioned Organized Noise earlier. There's a great documentary on Netflix, if you have not seen it, The Art of Organized Noise, which talks about Rico Way, Ray Murray, Sleepy Brown. For those that don't know, Sleepy Brown's dad was in the band Brick, and how, the dungeon was really the training ground for all of those acts that came out of Atlanta. And then, of course, once Waterfalls for TLC hit, that was when I think Organized Noise really got on nationally, because hip hop heads knew of Organized Noise when they were
Organized
working with
noise
Outkast, Goody
and
Mob,
getting
but when
my.
TLC hit, that was when Pop's like, okay, we got to pay attention to these guys. Can we talk about the influence of Organized Noise and what they meant to the Atlanta, what they still mean to the Atlanta scene?
Oh man, that's the original sound of Atlanta before, you know what I mean, besides, the bass sound, besides Social Def sound, that's one of the original sounds when it comes to Atlanta music. I mean, when it comes to hip hop in Atlanta, I mean, you can't talk about Outkast, Goody Mob, Dungeon Family without talking about Organized Noise and how their production was crazy. I mean, a different sound. I mean, it was unique from everything from Texas, unique from everything that was coming from Memphis, unique was coming from Miami. I mean, Social Def had his, Jermaine Dupri had his sound. There was a bass sound that was here in the city as well too, with the influence from Miami. But Organized Noise was the third sound that you had to mention, and you had to bring up when it comes to Atlanta. It's the first, it's the original, I guess you can call it hip hop sound. Because I mean, I think I call Jermaine Dupri R&B and hip hop because he does a lot of R&B production as well as hip hop production. But at the same time, when it comes to hip hop production, that gutter sound, you gotta get that to Organized Noise.
Yeah, and also at this time, B103 was really getting behind a lot of the Atlanta associated acts. So can we talk about B103 and its influence in Atlanta as Heritage Radio Station, knowing that that's the one station where if you're going to go break something in Atlanta, you got to go pay B103 a visit.
Yeah, it's definitely the Heritage Station in Atlanta. It was one of the first stations to start playing hip hop. I think they had that whole disclaimer situation where they're not playing rap before a certain time. But I think after 95, once Hot 97.5 came around, they started playing hip hop on a regular basis. But it's definitely the Heritage Station. It's, has some of the pioneers in the game. Everybody's been through there from Frank Ski to Greg Street, so forth and so on. But I think, definitely you have to mention B103 as one of the Heritage Stations and one of the stations that really ushered in hip hop when it came to Atlanta.
Yeah, and I didn't know this upon when I was doing my research on DJ Nav's that he's originally from NC, Bull City, and how he played a real heavy part in North Carolina hip hop. So shout out to DJ Nav's, and if you ever want to come on Beyond the Album Cover Nav's, come on. There's a spot for you. There's a spot for you, sir.
Shout out to Nav's, man.
Yeah,
Shout out to
definitely
Nav's.
shout out to Nav. So can we talk about art behind the tape and how that came to be with highlighting the mixtape culture?
Okay, definitely, definitely, definitely. Well, the book, The Art Behind the Tape, is right here. I brought a copy right here so you can check it out. But Art Behind the Tape is a book that me and DJ Mars came up with. I mean, the brainchild is DJ Mars. He came to me one day and was like, yo, I got an idea for a book highlighting the mixtape culture. And I was like, yo, that's interesting because at the time, there was a lot of books about hip hop coming out, whether it was the old school 80s, whether it was talking about the 90s era, talking about the graffiti era, the b-boy era, but nobody really talked about the mixtape era and how the mixtape was so important to hip hop culture. I call the mixtape like the sixth element of hip hop, or the sixth cousin of hip hop, basically the cousin of hip hop that nobody mentions because it's been there and it's been instrumental for hip hop for years, but at the same time, nobody really mentioned it. It always has been the back burner. It's kind of been some of the taboo thing to talk about when it comes to hip hop culture. So that was the main thing about it. So Mars came to me like, yo, I want to do this idea for this book on the mixtape culture. And he told me that he had started recording some interviews. So I would give these tapes and he had these interviews with DJ Vlad, Dax Lector, I mean, oh, you name it, Kid Capri, all these classical DJs telling their story, Ron G, telling them their mixtape story, how they started the mixtapes, what were some of their biggest mixtapes, why they got in the mixtape game, how they transitioned out of the mixtape game, and what they're doing now, and so forth and so on. So that was the main thing about it. So I was getting these tapes, I was just doing them, and I was like, yo, what they're saying right now is dope. This could be a book. So we decided to turn it into a book. We went full force with that.
And how you mentioned mixtapes was definitely one of those things where people get exposure of artists you wouldn't hear. Because I know for me, prime mixtape era, I was in high school, college. I first heard the Dream Team mixtape. I believe that was DJ Absolute, and it was Champions. And for me, hearing that Queen sample and just hearing Dame Dash say, "Man, Kanye, I didn't know you know how to rap." And that was my first exposure to Kanye. And this was
Kanye, exactly.
pre-college dropout. And how I had that track on repeat twice, and just the way that he took a rock record, made it hip hop, and it just made me just anticipate College Dropout even more and Through the Wire and all of his work. And how, it was just a special moment to where, like how we mentioned earlier, there was a meeting of the minds in those dorm rooms where you were exchanging mixtapes from New York, from Philly, from Cali, from Texas, from
Right.
wherever, and you were hearing acts before they were to blow. And
Right.
especially with Atlanta being its own ecosystem, you got to hear a lot of the Atlanta-based acts before they nationally came on. And when I've heard Jeezy Snowfall, it took me back to Gangsta Grizzles and long tall tees and Mitchell and Ness throwbacks, fitted caps. And I was like,
Yes.
ooh, a time was
Yes.
had if you were outside during that era.
Exactly. I remember talking about the whole mixtape, the ecosystem of being in a dorm and getting stuff from different people. I never forget the first time I heard Ether. My man Khalil, the RA from my dorm, was like, yo, y'all need to come down here right now. Nas is going in on Jay-Z. I forgot whose mixtape it was on. I think it was on K-Slay or possibly, I forgot who the mixtape was on, but he came and he's like, yo, y'all gotta come to my room right now, listen to this mixtape. Nas is going in on Jay-Z. And he played it for me, and it was off the mixtape. I remember hearing that. I remember hearing, so many classic records, like you said, Kanye West, hearing him on the We Are the Champions record. And then after that, hearing his freestyles on different mixtapes, and then finally getting his mixtape, one of his first mixtapes before the album dropped. So, I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, the mixtape scene was definitely something that was very important to hip hop. Like Dipset, G-Unit. I remember the buzz behind 50 Cent. Oh, man. My man from Queens, Thomas Till, had the poster for G-Unit behind his dorm freshman year. And I was like, yo, 50 Cent, the guy who got shot 9 times, how to rob. I was like, he's like, yo, give him a couple months, he's gonna be the highest dude in the game. Literally, I came back after freshman year, 02 to 03, 02, the summer of 02, I came back freshman year, 50 Cent was the biggest thing in the game.
Yeah, because I remember when Get Rich Die Trying hit, it was gangbusters. Because I remember hearing How to Rob, and I believe he had a Columbia album, Power of a Dollar, that was
Dollar, but it
supposed
never
to
came
drop,
out.
but it ended up getting scrapped.
He got shot, and then he was on silence. But after that, he came back, and I remember my man Thomas Till to the day from Queens, from Southside Jamaica, Queens. He was like, "Yo, my man works with 50 Cent. He's like, yo, he's gonna be the highest dude in the game." This was literally, I want to say January, February 02. He had the poster of I forgot the name, which one the mixtape, the green mixtape that he had, the first mixtape he had. One of the first mixtapes he had the poster on his wall, and I'm like, yo, 50 Cent, this dude right here. I remember him how to get robbed. I remember the first time I heard How to Rob, and I was like, yo, this dude was crazy. This dude was crazy, like for coming at people, everybody in the game like this. This dude has no fear. So I remember his name, 50 Cent, but then man, my man Thomas Till from Queens was like, yo, this dude right here is gonna be the highest dude in the game. He knew what was going on because the buzz in New York was on the mixtape scene. He had been dropping those mixtapes in New York, and it was just buzzing. So by the time 02, by the time the summer of 02 came, the mixtape was spread all over the country. Like, I mean, literally, it was everywhere then. And then I come back freshman, sophomore year in 02. My man Thomas was like, yo, I told you. And then literally a month later, Wingston comes out.
Yeah,
It
and
literally, literally a
yeah.
month, literally a month, Wingston comes, literally a month after that, Wingston comes out. A month before that, he signs the G-Unit Aftermath. 2 months after that, you have the cover with XXL with Dr. Dre, Eminem, and 50 Cent on the cover. So it planned out perfectly, and it's because of the mixtape scene. 50 Cent, Dipset, the way they was buzzing on the mixtape scene, mixtapes did that to them.
Yeah, and Dipset, man, you had to be there to understand the movement of Dipset, especially when Diplomatic Immunity hit. That album still play
Double
that
disc
to this day,
to this
man.
day, double disc album is crazy.
Yeah, man, I'm ready. I felt they should have opened up the battle with the locks if I'm ready. They should have. I was like, okay, because I thought, it was gonna be tit for tat, but Jada went Kobe 81 and lined them up in the
Carmelo,
line like Rakim was talking about in My Melody and ate them all at the same time.
right? Yeah, he went. He there was some great performances in the Madison Square Garden. Kobe for 61, Carmelo, Michael Jordan, and Jadakiss. Man, because Jadakiss had one of the greatest performances in the Madison Square Garden ever.
Yeah, he was like UConn currently in the NCAA tournament, just washing everybody, and how
Yeah.
the whole ecosystem of hip hop, whether you know it or not, it plays an instrumental role no matter what region you're in. Because I didn't know until I saw the No Limit Chronicles that No Limit got a start in the Bay Area in Richmond, California, before P went and took what he learned out there, went back to the
Back to the world.
504, and ended up applying that, and it became a big success.
Yeah, definitely. Like independent, like you said, the Bay, like I said before, the Bay Area is known for the independent mindset. I mean, they'll pop that trunk and sell that music. Like Too Short used to do it, E40 used to do it, and I think that Master P got that game from the Bay Area, took it down south, and the rest is history. So, I mean, big shout out to the Bay Area, big shout out to Master P for taking that knowledge and taking it down south. So, you gotta give props to them for that.
Right. And with hip hop celebrating its 50th last year, I was puzzled not to see Hammer on a lot of these tributes, but he had spoken at an event and said he had gotten invitations to all those events, but he declined. So it was good at least to hear that he was invited to the room, but on his own volition chose to decline. And I think this is for me to where hip hop was so concerned with maintaining its roots with being an underground scene that when you look at Hammer's pop ascent, that it was more so we're gonna lose the realness once we go to Iowa, to Idaho, to Kansas, to Nebraska, whereas now it's modus operandi. So I believe had Hammer came to one of those tributes, that would have been like an official apology to say we were wrong for dissing you so hard early on, and that is because of you, we are the success we are today.
Well, I was a kid at the time, so I didn't care. I was a fan. I didn't care if he was performing on, American Music Awards or he was performing in the hood. I was a Hammer fan. I mean, his birthday just passed through, so big shout out to Hammer and Sammy Burrell. His birthday was, I think, last week too as well. But Hammer was a legend. I mean, he was the first one to really take hip hop to the next level and be a superstar outside of just being a hip hop artist. He was a pop artist on top of that. He had a cartoon. He had lunch boxes. He had, he was in movies and featured on TV shows. He was everywhere, and you gotta respect that.
Yeah, please Hammer don't hurt him when Diamond. I mean, don't cross him though, because we've heard the stories. Like Outkast said, roll up on Hammer if you want to. Red Man
Red
talked
Man,
about the
man, definitely
time
went
where
out of control.
he tried to test
He got
Hammer.
checked.
Hammer said, don't let these baggy pants fool you.
And that's the thing about Hammer. People talk about, him not being hood, stuff like that. He had the old hood on his back, basically. Those 200 dancers and those people with security that was running from him, they were off of Oakland. He was giving them jobs and supporting them. So they had his back 100%. So there was no problem with Hammer showing love to the hood. So people always think that Hammer was he was pop and stuff like that. But Hammer was still hood and he could still take it there if he wanted to. And don't try him to this day.
Yeah, definitely don't try them. So I want to close out on this. You mentioned, the East Coast, West Coast beef, Biggie and Pop. Do you think had they both would have lived, that they both would have had to sit down and said, this was all stupid. We were in the midst of what was going on both coasts. We had people in our camps trying to pit us against each other, and it was just all one big misunderstanding.
Yeah, I think eventually they would have got together and really pieced it up, possibly. If cool heads would have prevailed, as well as them being in the room one-on-one, just talking and just really getting to the root of what the problem was, I think they would have probably squashed the beef and really got to a better place. But unfortunately, they were never able to do that. I think that it would have changed hip hop game totally different. The wheel what hip hop is today would have been totally different from what it is now. So I just, unfortunately, we never got that with them, but definitely, their music lives on and their memory lives on. But at the same time, I wish we would have had that, because at the time, the East Coast, West Coast beef was stupid. I mean, at the same time, like I said earlier, I said we were playing East Coast music just like I'm sure people out in East Coast were playing West Coast music. Where they was getting radio play out there just like we was getting radio play some records out there. I'm not sure. I'm not Don't quote me on that, but I know for sure in LA, 92.3 The Beat, Power 106 was playing East Coast records. I can go down Biggie's Life After Death album and play 10 to 12 albums they would play on the radio and still play on the radio to this day. So we got love for Biggie, we got love for Nas, we got love for Mobb Deep, we got love for all these artists that came out of the East Coast. There was a little friction between them two, Wu-Tang, there was all a little friction between, the artists and stuff like that, but it was small stuff. It was something that could have been gotten over with real easy and real quick.
Yeah, it's definitely enough room for everybody to eat. Death Row was out doing their thing. And then, of course, this is right around New York was in a lull, and Bad Boy brought New York back to the center. And then I think what made matters worse at the Source Awards was the fact that they were on New York turf, and the West, I think just that frustration always feeling like the little brother to New York and always having to
York.
fight to get that respect that, hey,
Right.
you're gonna respect us today. I ain't taking no more of these butt whoopings. You're gonna respect West Coast hip hop
Right.
today. So I'm thinking
Right.
that was all that was.
Yeah, that's all it was. I mean, people, I mean, they was there at that time and they had the number one, they West Coast was buzzing at the time. Dr. Dre, Snoop, Quick, you name it at the time, Dog Pound, everybody was buzzing at the time. West Coast had it on Smash, so they just wanted that respect. And I think they was, that's the one thing about West Coast, we've always wanted to get that respect from the East Coast, being the East Coast is the birthplace of new hip hop, birthplace of, you know, the boom bap. We always wanted to get that respect that, you know, y'all could do it out, y'all could do it out West too, just like we could do it out East. But we never, they said, we always felt that they never got that respect. That's why, you know, you always had the Slick Disses, you know, the West Side Connection came out with their music, you know, all the stuff that came out after that was a response to the reaction from the East Coast and how you guys never gave us that respect, never gave it that full respect of, oh, y'all got some spitters out there. I think as hip hop got older and as we got on, older on, people got more respect for, you know, different artists out of the West Coast. Snoop Dogg, Razzcast, you know, Corrupt as lyricism, you know, Dr. Dre as being being the number one producer in the game. So I think we got the respect that way. But at that time, early in the game, like you said, 95 Source Award, we wanted that respect. And being that we had the number one music in the game, we wanted and deserved that respect. So that's what it was.
Right, and then one female group that gets talked about, but they're looked at as a one-hit wonder because of Supasonic. But if it wasn't for Supasonic and the success of that, I believe that Straight Outta Compton probably weren't able to get funded, get made, because that record pretty much helped Ruthless. And that's
Yeah.
JJ Fad.
Yeah, JJ Fad, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a classic record right there to this day. But definitely, if that the record doesn't go out, we might not hear about Ruthless Records. We might not hear about NWA. Might not hear about, you know, Eazy-E. So it's a totally different story if things change with one thing going different. So it's definitely different.
And then also you could look at Wu-Tang and how if Prince Hakeem would have did numbers, and if GZA's record, the Come Do Me record, and the album with that did numbers, we wouldn't have Wu-Tang. And
Right.
how to have nine MCs, all of them can spit, and then RZA to have the visual foresight to say, nah, we're not gonna have all of us be on this label. If we get a solo deal, we're gonna spread it out to these different
Individually.
labels to
Right.
where we're gonna dictate to you and not the other way around. So can we just talk about Wu-Tang and just what they mean to hip hop and how when you look at them, they're like, to me, I look at them as rap version of New Edition, where they're great
Yeah.
together and solo.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Raps New Edition. I think like you said, the fortitude and the thought process of Arisen to say, hey, yo, I got nine guys right here that can all spit. I want to make sure that they all spit together as well as all spit individually, get all record individual record deals. I mean, one of the probably the most recognizable logo in hip hop probably is the Wu-Tang logo. Easily. I think I can't think of anything else bigger than that probably. Is the Wu-Tang logo. So just shows how big they are. And then they took it on a worldwide basis. I mean, like Wu-Tang to this day. I went to the Wu-Tang Nas concert that happened last year. The whole fan base, I mean, the biggest diverse fan base you can ever think of. White people, Japanese people, Black people, everybody, Hispanic people was there, all showing love for Wu-Tang. So one of the biggest groups in the hip hop game ever. I think it would put them top five of all time.
Yeah, rest in peace, ODB. Wu-Tang is for the children. So can we talk
Yeah.
about current projects that you got going on?
Current projects are going on. Still got the Art Behind the Tape book itself. Go to the website, artbehindthetape.com. Have the podcast. We're coming back with season two in a few weeks. We're going to see some more interviews, some more classic interviews, talking to some of the people that put down for the mixtape culture. So you can be look out for that. Also have a project with me, DJ Mars, called First Day on Campus, and my partner Mel Davis, called First Day on Campus, firstdayoncampus.com. It's a bridge of aiming to bridge the first day on campus to the alumni. We have products through partnerships through Starter as well as New Era. So you check out the website. We have some jackets there from Clark Atlanta. We have some hats there from Howard University, Hampton University, Morgan State, Southern, Tuskegee. as well as Haskins Park, Atlanta. So check out the product we got there, and just always on the grind, man. I work for iHeartMedia, so I'm always grinding, working, staying busy, man. So hit me up on social media, BrillNJI 2.0. Well, BrillNJI, BrillNJIE. And Jarrell, man, thank you for this opportunity, man, to talk to you about hip hop, man. If you want to give me on another time, man, definitely I'd love to talk some more, man.
Yes, sir. I saw the starter gear. Shout out to Morris, who I had on the podcast. I definitely got to get that so I can flip the hat, twist the hat, bend the hat, like what Jazzy
Yes.
Jeff was talking about in them starter commercials. If you know, you know. So, any shout outs you
Yes.
want to give before we conclude, bro?
Man, shout out to the whole hip hop community, man. Everybody's always showing love to me. My family, of course, my wife, my son, RB on the Tape family, of course, my man DJ Mars, Ty St. Louis, Ty St. Boogie, my man Maurice Garland, everybody helping with the project, my man Ken, who's helped out with the RB on the Tape podcast. And just everybody is always holding down, listening. Everybody's listening to you right now, Jarrell, man. Appreciate you guys supporting and listening to us, man.
Yes, sir. And you can catch this interview wherever you stream podcasts and on the website, Beyond the Album Cover, YouTube, wherever you stream, facebook.com/beyondthealbumcover. Ladies and gentlemen, let's give a big thank you and round of applause for my bro, Brill Enjoy, for coming on Beyond the Album Cover. Brill, thank you for coming on, my man.
Definitely, thank you for having me, man. Appreciate it, man. I definitely want to come back on, man. We can do part two about this, talk some more West Coast music, talk some more East Coast music. Had a great conversation with you, man. Definitely, man. Appreciate it.
For sure.